Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 5th, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. If you saw Lyndon LaRouche on this week's LaRouche Pack TV Weekly Report, then you're aware that an extremely dangerous global strategic crisis has gotten worse, given the decision of the British Empire to order their puppet, U.S. President Barack Obama, the Nero of the United States, to escalate his war drive beyond Libya to Iran and Syria. Mr. LaRouche said this creates the danger of a nuclear confrontation between the United States and Russia and China. Yes, you heard it right. The threshold for nuclear war has been reduced, and such a war becomes increasingly likely as long as that madman Obama is president. If you didn't see this week's weekly report, I recommend you watch it immediately after this program to get the full report from Mr. LaRouche himself. On today's LaRouche Show, we're privileged to have as our guest one of the leading strategic thinkers on our planet, Helga Zepp LaRouche. She's the chairman of the Busso Political Party in Germany and the founder of the Schiller Institute. She has distinguished herself over the recent years through a consistent on-the-scene analysis of the breakdown of the Eurozone and her role in organizing an alternative to it. And we're very lucky, I can tell you, to have her on today because she has an extremely busy schedule given the nature of the crisis. So we'll be discussing these themes on today's program. But I want to begin with the increasing threat of an outbreak of general war, which could minimally finish off the already devastated transatlantic financial system. Helga, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello.
Why don't we begin by you giving us your assessment of where we stand at present with this war danger, and how it was pushed ahead with the side discussions of this week's G20 meeting in Cannes.
Well, the problem is that about 5 days ago, there was a sudden revelation in the Israeli press about a preparation of a Israeli strike against Iran being pushed by Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak. And the so-called pretext for that was the upcoming report of the International Atomic Energy Commission about the state of the Iranian nuclear program, which is supposed to come out this coming Monday, where supposedly there should be some sensational revelation about the progress of the Iranian program or the intention to use the next coming 10 months to hide the nuclear facility underground so that then the option of doing something about it would no longer exist, and therefore a strike against these Iranian capabilities would be mandatory immediately. So then this caused a complete uproar inside Israel because all the heads of the intelligence services and military command, the Joint Chief of Staff, the head of the Mossad, the head of the Shin Bet, and the previous heads of these institutions all came out saying that such a military strike against Iran would be, first of all, not necessary because there would be no existential threat to Israel, and secondly, it would not only affect Israel, but it would, you know, turn the whole region into 100 years of destruction.
So the Israeli press was reporting that there was significant opposition within the military and the intelligence establishment in Israel.
Yes, yes. And the former head of the Mossad, even, you know, when Netanyahu announced that he would investigate where this leak came from, this former head basically said, well, let him investigate me. I'm standing up to what I'm saying. Now, obviously, this is a extremely dangerous situation because already previous to this revelation, there was a tremendous reinforcement of American armed forces in the region. There are presently an enormous amount of war ships. There are 3 aircraft carriers from the United States. 2 are in the Indian Ocean, or rather in the Gulf, and one is in the Eastern Mediterranean, then you have a large number of frigates and destroyers with very advanced missile defense systems there, and you have a large troop contingent. You have still 30,000 troops in Iraq. You have 20,000 troops in the Gulf states. Then naturally you have almost 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. So if you look at that concentration of military power in the region, it is much beyond what would be necessary, for example, to, quote, support the rebels in Syria. And, you know, obviously, the shift which has occurred in the strategic situation after the war against Libya, after the assassination of Gaddafi, and now, you know, with the momentum fully on for regime change in Syria and Iran, I think this is very, very dangerous because, I mean, anybody who knows the military situation in the region, first of all, Israel could not possibly attack Iran by itself. I mean, it just if you look at the military power of Iran and that of Israel, I mean, it just that wouldn't work. So therefore, obviously, this large U.S. presence there is what really is the question. And then you had a couple of days ago this report in The Guardian, the British Guardian reporting that the British Defense Ministry has sent a large contingent of the British Navy to support the American move against Iran into the same Gulf region. So you have practically the U.S., you have the British, and you have Israel all on a motion for a strike against Iran.
Now, and I assume the French are also in on it, given Sarkozy's role in the Libyan war and also his meeting with Obama in France.
Well, there were just Israeli maneuvers of F-16 in Sardinia, testing long-range deployments in-flight refueling. And, you know, Israel also tested the Yericho missile, which is capable of having nuclear warheads and is in its reach sufficient to reach the territory of Iran. So, you know, that all is really extremely worrisome. And the headlines in the German press just this morning are saying, you know, the world should be prepared for an Israeli strike against Iran. And, I mean, there was absolutely hectic diplomatic activity in the last 2 weeks. You had Blair in the United States visiting right. Obama. Then you had the British defense chief of staff in Israel. You had Barak, the defense minister, in London. So there was a clear coordination on all of this. And, you know, there are several military experts in the European continent who have said in the past and who are saying it again that, you know, the danger is if you have a military strike against Iran, that is the beginning of World War III, because obviously it doesn't stop there, because Iran has already said that they will that there will be apocalyptic consequences. Now, the minimum what they would do is they would obviously also hit American targets. There are plenty of those in the region. You have the large concentration of troops in Afghanistan, Iraq. Then you have a whole bunch of bases, NATO bases, American bases. You have the British base, Diego Garcia. So you could easily imagine how this thing would spread. Then under these conditions, you know, the Hezbollah for sure would get involved, because if there would be an attack on Iran, then they would have probably a renewed war, Lebanon against Israel. And in the last war, 2006, Israel did not do so well in this war. So yeah, the whole thing would immediately get out of control. And
Helga, let me ask you on this. In your husband Lyndon LaRouche's newest paper, Principle or Party, he writes that both Russia and China know they are targets, and that there's been this discussion in China. You have the U.S. Senate essentially declaring financial warfare, economic warfare against China. What options would there be? I mean, this could spread very quickly beyond the what Lynn is calling the new Balkans into Eurasia.
Well, I mean, first of all, Russia has said very clearly that they regard any military intervention against Syria as unacceptable. Then, naturally, if you have such a war scenario as I was just in the process of describing, it is in the nature of things that, you know, that sooner or later nuclear weapons would be used. And once that occurs, then everything is going out of control because, you know, as people should know from the history of world wars, these things never happen exactly, you know, as they are planned because then they tend to get out of control. And you have the additional problem that, you know, there is a huge parallel to the prehistory of World War One, insofar as at that point it was the development of infrastructure in the Eurasian continent, the Trans-Siberian Railway, the railway from Berlin to Baghdad, which, you know, threatened the ocean superiority of the British Empire at that point. And then we had all kinds of geopoliticians, Milner, Mackinder, who then basically developed this crazy theory of geopolitics that whoever controls the Eurasian heartland is controlling the planet, and that would put in a disadvantage the transatlantic regions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at it, it's exactly like that today, because while the transatlantic world is collapsing in a systemic financial collapse, you have some of the Asian large nations doing relatively well. You have still a significant growth rate in China, in India, and Russia. And, you know, it is very clearly that there are some people in the what we call the British Empire oligarchy who do not want to have the Asian nations take off and go in the direction of manned space travel, high technology, fourth generation of nuclear power, and all of these developments, while the transatlantic world is collapsing and you know, disintegrating. So there is no question that there is this larger scenario to involve Russia and China. And I think the world has never been in such a dangerous moment right now, because the coincidence of the systemic collapse of the transatlantic financial system, which was highlighted, you know, with the total theater around the G20 summit,
right,
which just concluded, where, you know, I mean, it's very clear the Eurozone is failing. It was a failed experiment. And also the U.S. banking system is bankrupt. The French banks are bankrupt. And the whole European banks are all practically bankrupt. That it is the coincidence of these two events, you know, the collapse of the system and the taking off of the Asian powers, which causes this war dynamic.
You're listening to Helga Zepp LaRouche, our guest today on a very special LaRouche show. We're discussing what is now up on the LaRouche PAC website from the weekly report on last Wednesday from Lyndon LaRouche, and also his new paper, Principle or Party, Dumb Democrat. Now, Helga, you mentioned the G20, and of course you've been forcefully fighting for some time for a return to sovereign nation states. We saw this, as you put it, basically bad theater in Cannes. But let's just start with the whole question of the what's happening in the Eurozone from the top, because the story is much bigger than Greece. And of course, you've been covering this from the beginning. What is the likelihood that the Eurozone is going to survive?
Well, in my view, it's zero, because, you know, what they're trying to do now is simply going to turn the affected countries into miserable collapse zones. I mean, first of all, this whole game with Papandreou going for a referendum, then no, then, you know, winning the no confidence vote by one vote, but agreeing to be replaced soon by an interim government and then go for early election. I mean, all of that does not address the fact that the brutal austerity policy which is imposed on Greece is simply, you know, turning this country into a nightmare. Mm-hmm. The economy has shrunk by, I think, a quarter or more. Unemployment in some regions is 60%. We have more than 40% youth unemployment throughout the country. People are just desperate. I mean, the mood in Greece is one of complete desperation in the population. And it goes along with an increasing anger and even hatred against those which they think are imposing these policies. And they naturally look at Mrs. Merkel and they look at the EU bureaucracy. And, you know, so the tension has become quite significant. But then you look what happened at the G20 summit. In addition to that, you had the Italian crisis now taking center stage, because obviously Greece is relatively small in terms of that it has only 2% of the GDP of the Eurozone. But Italy is the third largest country, and they have almost $2 trillion debt. And, you know, it is that debt owed in large part, you know, to European banks, American banks, but especially European banks, which is now the issue. And so what was decided, well, first of all, in the EU summit a couple of days earlier, Sarkozy and Merkel, you know, cornered Berlusconi and told him to impose brutal austerity by, you know, slashing the unemployment status and imposing the European standard, which is much more unfavorable to the population. And then when Berlusconi went home, he could not really get the agreement of his cabinet and especially the Lega North to go along with that. So what happened then at the summit, where Berlusconi essentially came without an agreement backed by his own government, they imposed the same kind of troika to go to Rome and basically turn Italy into a protectorate. So basically the same troika consisting out of the European Central Bank, the European Union Commission, and the IMF has basically been deployed to Rome to implement there the austerity program demanded by the EU and the IMF.
Now, Helga, the, you know, the press is saying that Berlusconi has accepted this. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think Berlusconi is basically trying to maneuver to stay in power, which I don't think will be a long perspective. But, you know, the thing which I want to emphasize is, I mean, what has become of the idea which is, you know, supposedly the great idea of Europe, of unity, of peace, of all of these nice things which mm-hmm. the pro-Europe faction has been saying, when you turn your own members into protectorates.
Right.
I mean, I think this is the total bankruptcy of this conception because, you know, this European Union has become an open dictatorship acting against the interest of its own members. And I don't think it will last. I don't think the Greek population will take it. I don't think the Italian population is going to accept this. As a matter of fact, the Italian trade unions have already announced a general strike. And this time it is the trade unions of the left and the right, you know, working together on the strike perspective. And, you know, it's what should become out of this? You know, I mean, Europe is not a dictatorship. Europe can only function if it's an alliance of sovereign nations and not run by a supranational bureaucracy which has completely you know, taken a life of its own, and it's not accountable to anybody. You know, they have an increasing budget of, I think, a trillion euros, and they are living a very privileged life, but they act against the populations, and I don't think this will last.
Well, Helga, you made another point recently on the irony of the situation in Greece with the discussion of a referendum, and then the bankers basically howling about that. You've called for a referendum in Germany. And I know this is a subject which is taken up by the Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe. It's rippling through the political parties there. I mean, what is the possibility now of a referendum on the euro bailout in Germany? And will the Merkel government survive?
Well, I think that the problem in Germany, obviously, is that the opposition, mainly the SPD, the Social Democracy, and the Greenies, they are worse than even the Merkel government, even if that's hard to top. Because, for example, just today, there are articles in the media that the former Chancellor Schröder came out with the explicit demand that Germany should dissolve in a federalized Europe. Mm. Now, I think this is absolutely absurd. And the referendum I called for was not on the bailout policy, but on the idea to have a European government,
right,
either in
right.
the form of a European economic government or in the form of a United States of Europe or some form of European government, because that, according to the German Grundgesetz, at Article 146, demands a referendum. A referendum is generally not foreseen in the Grundgesetz, except if you try to change the Grundgesetz, then you need a referendum. And it was the ruling of Karlsruhe, the Constitutional Court, in the famous Lisbon Treaty ruling of June 2009, where they said that if there are any more steps in the direction of a European government beyond what has been established by this Lisbon ruling by Karlsruhe, then you need a referendum. Now, there are some people like the Social Democrats, the Greenies, and I think also some people in the other parties who are openly saying, yes, we should have a referendum openly for a European government, and they are convinced that they get the majority of the population behind it. I doubt that very, very much, because I think that if people really would have the choice for the first time to vote, it would take exactly the same result as it was with the referendums in France and in Holland in 2005 on the first draft of the European Constitution, which overwhelmingly was defeated. And that was the whole reason why then this strange commission redrafted the text of the Constitution and just changed 5% and then turned it, named it a treaty and not a constitution, because on a treaty you don't need a referendum, which was a sophistic trick. And then they rammed through the Lisbon Treaty essentially behind the backs of the population in total secrecy, which was a complete scandal all by itself. And therefore, I'm absolutely convinced that if you would have a referendum, it would lead to a defeat. As a matter of fact, in November 2007, there was a report that Sarkozy had a meeting with some European Parliament members in Strasbourg, in which he said that basically, you know, one should avoid having referendums by all means, because in every country where you would put a referendum to the population, it would get lost, and therefore one should try to avoid that.
Mm-hmm.
I think if it comes to that, let's have a referendum. you know, let's really have the population say what they want. I mean, we have a lot of organizing and information tables every day in Germany, and we know that the population is very polarized. There are many, many people who do not agree to the continuation of the bailout policies in favor of the banks and to the disadvantage of the taxpayer. There are also many people who would like to have a return to the D-mark. And I think the question of a European government is just not going to work if you ask the population. So let's have a referendum, and I think that the result will be very, very clearly in favor of the nation state and in favor of the German Grundgesetz and against the idea of a European supranational governments of dictators.
Well, Helga, I think if we put these two issues together, as you did at the beginning, that you have on the one side the collapse of the financial system and the drive toward dictatorship, and on the other side you have this very clear war, drumbeat for war coming from particularly the British and the United States, are people able to make the connection that you think, and the people you're meeting with in Europe, make the connection between the desperation of the bankers going for this fascist policy, which is not popular, and their willingness to risk war?
Well, it varies. You know, you have people who, for example, who are experts on the Middle East and on the Gulf, and they totally 100% confirm that this build-up is there, that a strike against Iran means World War III. I mean, I know of several people who absolutely say that, who are really worried, but they sometimes are experts and they don't necessarily make the connection to the financial crisis. There are other people who up to recently have been relatively oblivious to the danger of war, but did see very clearly, you know, that the danger is of the financial collapse, that this is a threat to democracy, that the whole parliamentarian process has basically already been eliminated, and, you know, that this is the danger of fascism. But there are also people who basically have made the connection between these two processes and have, you know, confirmed and even brought up own examples that in history, in the past, you had several occasions where collapsing empires or collapsing systems would resort to war in order to regain control over an otherwise untenable situation. So I think that, you know, there is a big fear right now. I think that the people are really scared because this is the existence of civilization, you know, and even some of these Israeli opponents to the war have said that, you know, they see a danger to peace and stability in the region for 100 years to come. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a moderate estimate of what would happen if you would have nuclear war.
Right, right. Well, we're listening to Helga Zepp-LaRouche, who is my guest today on The LaRouche Show. Extremely dramatic moment in history. And Helga, you recently spent some time in the United States and were actively involved in organizing in Washington, working with the web team and at LaRouche PAC in Purcellville, also with the six-candidate slate, congressional slate. What was your overall impression of the political situation in the U.S. and the development of the LaRouche movement in intervening to change things?
Well, I think it was extremely impressive to see, you know, how actually, you know, the various forces in Washington have been responding to organizers from the LaRouche PAC and the former youth movement. You know, they're now all in their tweener age, or not all of them, but many. And in a certain sense, you know, I think that it's very clear that, you know, in the United States, you have these two traditions. You have the, let's say, Anglophile American Anglo-American Special Relationship Faction, which unfortunately exists in Wall Street and in the in both parties there are such people. But then you have the American Revolution tradition, you know, Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, John Quincy Adams, Lincoln, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Martin Luther King, and you can actually see how the intervention of our people is catalyzing this best tradition of the United States. And you know, I know that the whole world is to the extent that they know that this is the fight, and they have not been, you know, I mean, the danger is that the last two terms of W. Bush and now the term of Obama have led to such an increase of anti-Americanism in the world that people tend to forget that these two traditions exist. But, you know, if this fight can be catalyzed so that, you know, the real America comes forth, it would be so easy, you know, to extend, you know, a hand to the world and really end this period of misery. You know, for example, there was this article by Hillary Clinton in Foreign Affairs where she laid out the perspective, you know, for the next 100 years that the relation between the United States and China will be absolutely crucial. And this obviously is in stark contrast to these other tones which come from, you know, certain Pentagon reports about the military threat coming from China, and, you know, which is completely absurd. I mean, just look at the military power of the United States and compare that to that of Russia or China, then you can see that this military superiority is in no way threatened. So I think that, you know, what I have seen is that the candidates movement and, you know, other people organizing in La Rouge-Pec, they are really fighting for the soul of America in the way everybody would want America to be, namely a beacon of hope and a temple of liberty and America of the ideals of the American Revolution. And one can only hope that this fight, you know, somehow can be decided in such a way that, you know, America can come back to itself.
Well, I want to ask you in a moment about the potential, the tremendous potential for development that's possible now. But I just have one more question, just to go back to this war danger and the what has to be done to move it. What is your view at this point of the potential to remove Obama from what you saw in the United States? And then secondly, you mentioned now that there's a growing hatred of Obama internationally. That, of course, has been a dramatic change. So I'd like you to just give your thoughts on these two things, the potential to remove Obama and the change in view of the United States under the Obama presidency.
Well, I think that there were several comments about the Obama performance at the G20 meeting, which just concluded, and there were general agreement that all of this messianic glamour which existed during the election campaign has completely disappeared, and you know, Obama also was described as not having had a leading role in this summit at all, that he was just one of many. And so, I mean, the whole mystique for sure has completely vanished.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Libya war, which was a full-fledged war,
right,
you know, people in Africa, I mean, we had several people from African nations who said this was the first Afro-American president who at the same time also bombed an African country, and that this was a complete atrocity. And also this question of the targeted assassinations has totally, you know, really ruined the image of Obama in the Arab world, in the African world. And, you know, I think people really have completely lost any illusion that Obama is any different than Bush and Cheney were. As a matter of fact, they say he's doing the same thing, and as Cheney correctly said, he's doing it better than even them. So I think there is a complete, total disillusionment everywhere.
And you have a sense that there are people moving to stand up, or we still have this problem in the United States of people still going along with Obama for fear of Republicans winning the 2012 election?
Well, I think that there is, I think that there is still too much complacency. I mean, here we are in the rundown for World War III, and it's not a long-term perspective, but, you know, several experts confirmed that this is a danger for the next 2 weeks. Now, I don't know all the weather reasons and other reasons which are given of why this is an immediate time window of 2 weeks. But one thing should be also very clear, that you cannot maintain such large troop presence for months and years. You know, this is a short-term military build-up. And, you know, also, you know, the whole drumbeat is becoming louder and louder. So either it is being, you know, stopped, or it will go to war. So I think that you know, there is no room for complacency. We are on the verge of World War III. And, you know, whatever needs to be done to stop that, you know, people better wake up, because, you know, if you have World War III, forget it. Neither you nor I nor anybody listening to this program will have a chance to contemplate about it, because we will be all dead. Because if you have now an escalation for nuclear war, there is no way of telling where it will stop. And with the nuclear arsenals which exist in the world, you know, we may look at the extinction of civilization, you know, at least in any shape or form as we have known it. So, you know, I mean, people should really wake up. This U.S. military presence has been built up. The British are sending their navy there. You know, whole world is being prepared by the media that this will happen. So there is no margin of doubt. You know, I'm not making this up. This is you know, intelligible for anybody who can read newspapers or look in the internet. It's all there. You know, this is short term. This is very short term.
Well, presuming we make it through this, and that's going to take an effort from our listeners and those of you who are listening today to Helga, it's in your hands. You can be sure that Lynn and Helga and the LaRouche movement is doing what it can, but it's up to you to get out and talk to people and mobilize and put out the word that the madman in the White House has to go, and we have to go back to the, as what Helga called, we have to fight for the soul of America. And she's not just talking to me about this, she's talking to you about doing this. Now, Helga, in this context, probably one of the most significant roles that you've played over the last decades has been in promoting the idea of development, of the peaceful development of the planet and beyond, with the extraterrestrial imperative. This has been something that was at the heart of the founding of the Schiller Institute. And we now see a potential, if we can, as you say, make it through this immediate period, the potential that exists with the Chinese, with their moves with the space program this week, with the announcement several weeks ago of Prime Minister Putin that he will be running for president and that he's running on a completely different policy than the British would like, of a monetarist Russia. He's actually talking about collaboration with China and anyone else, including possibly the United States, for the development of Siberia. All of this comes right back to what you have been doing for years with the Trans-Siberian Development Perspective, the Silk Road Lady, and so on. What is the perspective now for this, and how do we get this across to people that there is life after Bush and Obama?
Well, I think that the question really is, will we be able, by we, I mean we as mankind, will we be able to in time put the political and economic order in cohesion with the laws of the universe? Now, what I mean by that is that, you know, as we have been discussing repeatedly, the whole development of the physical universe clearly shows that there is the law of anti-entropy working in the universe for hundreds of millions of years and beyond. And man being in the universe as being part of this universe is also having laws of his own creative thinking, which have to be anti-entropic for man to continue to exist. Now, that means a continuous emphasis on scientific and technological progress, on improving the conditions of life for mankind, and conquering ever more deep insights into the lawfulness of the physical universe. You know, there is no limit to that. Now, this total agreeing to the idea of scientific and technological progress has been the fundament of any economy which was progressing. This was the case for Germany for a long time. This was the case for the United States. And it is now the case for Russia and China. China wants to become the leading space power in the world. They have plans to have manned space travel. They want to mine the moons of helium-3 and other precious raw materials. They want to go to Mars as quickly as possible. And the same thing is true for Russia. And they also plan to go, you know, into other advanced research, first generation nuclear reactors, high temperature reactor. They want to go in a crash program for fusion power. All of this is healthy, normal human activity.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the transatlantic region of the world, especially in Europe, but I think also to a very large extent in the United States, there they have gone to a complete monetarist conception associated with green technology, with the idea that you want to go to so-called sustainable development, sustainable energy, renewable energy. And all of that is basically based on this, on a conception of the planet and the universe which don't exist, namely as if the world would be, you know, some kind of a closed system where you have to have sustainable development, you have to have, you reach an equilibrium, and now you have to save energy, save resources, reduce population. So it's a complete wrong conception about the physical universe. They are in the transatlantic world. They're really behaving as if the universe would be, you know, as if you would have a little, you know, like a box in the universe, and the planet would be, you know, at least the transatlantic part of the world would be in this closed system, and you would have to try to live on the basis of a zero growth economy, and it just does not work. You know, if you look at the development of the universe at large, then you can see clearly that countries like Russia, China, South Korea, India, even Japan after Fukushima are all going in the direction of surmounting existing challenges by better technology, by better scientific progress, and they are behaving, you know, as they should behave, while the transatlantic world is in this totally oligarchical, zero-growth kind of a mode, and you know that is the biggest danger. So I think that the real challenge right now is, can we in the United States and in Europe go back to traditions which were, you know, coming from better times? Why should the United States not do what Russia and China are doing by going back to the moon? You know, I mean, isn't it a challenge to the pride of Americans to see that Russia and China are planning joint manned moon and Mars missions when NASA is being shut down and manned space travel has been closed down? The United States should join with Russia and China. And I want, you know, I mean, the only good thing which happened in the recent period was that you had the recent joint Chinese-German space mission, where basically, you know, a very healthy cooperation took place. And I think the future of mankind is in that direction. And then we can, you know, spin off all these technologies and make the planet a livable place, you know, for all human beings. 7 billion people must have a decent life, and it would be so easy. How easy would it be to overcome poverty in Africa? We have all the technologies, you know. I mean, we have worked on development programs for Africa since the 70s, and we have, you know, continuously updated them, and there is no reason in the world why you have such a misery in this continent right now, because all the means to immediately get infrastructure programs, to get water management, irrigation, desalinization, turn the deserts into gardens, that would all be so easy. And if you think how much money has been spent on this toxic money sitting in bankrupt banks, trillions and trillions, if only a percentage of that money would have been spent for African development, we would have nobody dying of hunger there. And I think it's high time that we change the system so that it serves the civilization and not civilization is being sacrificed for this system.
Well, this is, of course, a very stark picture of differences when you look at what you just described as the development potential versus the war danger and the breakdown of the financial system and the imposition of killer policies. I mean, we're not just talking about bad policies. We're talking about nations being destroyed in their capacity to take care of their people, their populations. Now, given how clear it is and how unhappy, I would say from what I've seen in Europe and my organizing in the United States, that very few people are happy with the situation. Clearly, there's something more that has to be done than just giving people a sense of an alternative. And this is where we get to this question of the renaissance and the creative potential of mankind. So how do you go about when you have discussions with people and you run up against their sense of, well, that sounds all well and good, but people won't do it? How do you address that part of it, Helga?
Well, I think that you see right now that there is a complete divide between the leading governments and institutions, the so-called political class and establishment on the one side, and the aspiration of the populations on the other side. I think this has been expressed by the so-called Arab Spring, which started in Tunisia, then it went to Egypt, and, you know, then it took somehow a slightly disorderly continuation, mainly because the one thing was not happening what I said should have happened in immediately, namely that you needed to have real economic development. But then it spread, you know, to Spain, it's there in Greece. Then it took the form of the so-called Indignado movement, which spreads all over the place in Europe. You have the Occupy movement in the United States. And, you know, while all of these expressions may not be homogeneous and pure, and you have many elements in them, nevertheless, you know, there is simply the fact that you have an increasing separation of the populations and the institutions which are ruling the population. So in a certain sense, you know, I have no idea where this will end up. You could have a breakdown of the banking system, which could happen, you know, triggered by, you know, a run on the banks in any country, or the collapse of a big bank too big to fail, or some crazy process in the shadow banking area, or some insane computer speculating on nanosecond differences in currency values. I mean, you have so many minefields which could trigger a sudden collapse of the system. And, you know, if you would have a run on the banks internationally, you know, in 1 or 2 days, you could have no food supplies, you could have no credit cards, no electricity, no handys function, no gasoline. And then you would have what? You would have a dark age. You would have chaos. So that could happen. So therefore these demonstrations and so forth, they're a tricky thing. You know, they could turn into a Jacobean terror in no time if you have an unfortunate sequence of events. On the other side, you know, I think it is also, there is the potential that, you know, it could take the turn like with the fall of the wall in 1989, you know, that these kinds of pressures coming from the population also in the streets are necessary to tell these corrupt politicians that they have to move. But there is no solution possible if you do not have the immediate implementation of Glass-Steagall in the United States. And I think that people really have to understand, because of the condition in Europe, the fact that Europe has unfortunately come very far in the direction of an open dictatorship, for the reason that other parts of the world, like, you know, Russia, China, India, while these cultures have big, you know, merits and good things, I don't think that they will have that they will come up with a global initiative to address this global crisis. So therefore, simply by default and by the very history of the United States has a very unique responsibility to make this step of Glass-Steagall, for the simple reason that it has happened already once. Franklin D. Roosevelt pulled the United States out of the Depression with the combination of Glass-Steagall, the New Deal, the Pecora Commission, the Tennessee Valley Authority Reconstruction Program. So therefore, if the United States would do this Glass-Steagall Act, then, you know, I know immediately it would jump to Europe and it could happen in other parts of the world. Then I think we have a chance. And then I think, you know, the question of, you know, basically turning the system back into a system which serves civilization could happen. I think we have culturally a gigantic problem. It's not unsolvable, but, you know, it's the other thing which really worries me to a very large extent, because if you look at the youth culture, for example, today, if you look at the absolute pit which, you know, the degeneracy of the popular culture from, you know, pornography to the various forms of Satanist pop music varieties, ugliness and so forth, the how it has affected the children of, you know, 8-10 years already.
Yeah.
You know, I think we have a gigantic problem, and to undo that, you need a real effort by a lot of good people. I know it can be done because, you know, for example, when my husband, Lyndon LaRouche, started to work with the youth, you know, to create a Renaissance movement, to go back to classical culture, to classical music, to study basic discoveries in science. All of that can be done, and I know that you know, people get very excited when they see that this is so much more beautiful and so much more ennobling. I think it can be done, but it would require, you know, I mean, we have done it as a private effort. You know, we have been teaching bel canto singing to young people. We have been, you know, encouraging people to do all the great discoveries of all great thinkers of the past, to, you know, basically have a real, you know, Humboldt kind of education system. But it was done as a private effort. But I think to undo the absolute damage which has occurred in the last, I don't know exactly, 40 years and longer, you know, you would have to have good government. You know, you would have to have governments who care for the creative potential of their own populations. You would have to reinstate opera, classical theater, you know, other arts, classical arts in painting, in architecture. You would have to scrap a whole bunch of horrible developments And I think it's a gigantic job. You know, I don't think it's a little job. I think it really requires that people wake up. And the thing which freaks me out the most is that you can see civilization clashing against the wall so clearly, and how few people have the guts to step forward and say, we need a change. We need to change the whole way of how we have been thinking about things. We have to go back to, you know, to basic human values, to the idea of, you know, creativity being the, you know, what constitutes the pursuit of happiness in life, and not some stupid money or some other possessions of earthly paradise. And I, you know, I hope that people hear, you know, what we are saying, and that they come forward before it is too late, because we are sitting on a powder keg which could detonate in no time. And, you know, the only thing which I have as a hope is that, you know, that Leibniz, who after all had a big input in the American Declaration of Independence, he said that, you know, the best of all possible worlds consists out of the fact that every great evil in the world brings forward an even greater good. So I have a basic trust and confidence that that may happen, and I hope we can be the decisive factor to turn it around.
Well, Helga, I think we'll leave it at that. It was a very beautiful summary, and the continuation of this battle. We've got to stop the war. People who are listening have a responsibility to not just complain, but to, and not just to oppose Obama, but to take this last part of what Helga Zeppler-Rusch discussed in terms of making yourself a better person by looking at this potential creative being in yourself and in other people and act to bring that out. So Helga, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll be back next week with another edition of the LaRouche Show.
Yes, goodbye.
Bye.